Chapter 21, Dublin Brothel Episode. Civil law enforcement in Ireland has never been a serious problem. The penal records of the land compare most radiantly with any country in the world. Civil crime, burglary, arson, and the long variety of indictments familiar to the American jurist are rare to the courts of Erin. The casualty list of American bootleggers and associated racketeers is greater in a single year than the total killed and wounded in the Irish strife with England in 1921 and 1922. Lack of respect for English law makes the Irishman circumspect in his dealings with his neighbour. He is not a sharp trader, and a word is as binding as a contract. During the lull of hostilities in 1921, the Irish Republicans established the Sinn Féin courts, which were, in essence, courts of arbitration. The people ignored the English legal machinery in civil disputes and were satisfied with the common-sense justice that came from a competent Sinn Féin judge, who often was not a professional lawyer. There was no need for strong-arm tactics to enforce the decisions in civil disputes. The judgment of the court was always accepted as final. During the Irish War, the police forgot their civil duties and were concerned only with their military assignments. It was a strange anomaly to find policemen guilty of pillage and arson. Here was a body of men sworn to the enforcement of civil law and the protection of the citizen, turning to the role of a crime instigator and perpetrator. The English courts broke down, but due to the confidence of the people, the Republican courts were equal to the task. And that faith was not limited to any class or religion. The judges leaned over backwards to give a Southern Protestant a square deal. The Sinn Féin courts were really an echo of the old Brion system of jurisprudence. The Brion laws governed Ireland until the 17th century, when the Parliament of Britain, at the heel of the invader, crushed a code that was as simple and logical as the Ten Commandments. If a man murders another, the modern law, based on complicated systems from Justinian to Blackstone, decrees that the state declare the offender's life forfeit and kill him. Not so with the Brions. The murderer atoned for his crime by supporting the family of the dead man and paying substantially for the crime throughout his whole life. Compensation is more adequate to the offence than revenge, and all Brion judgments were based on this trend of logic. Brion law was the outgrowth of the tribal government of the land, which is essentially communistic. Under the old lawgivers, man was entitled to personal property, weapons, clothing, and adornments, but everything else belonged to the clan or sept. Such a system of government reduced the lust for large personal fortune and guaranteed an equal distribution of worldly goods. Brion law dealt not with the complexities of the 20th century, but for 1,500 years in Ireland it served the true ends of justice fairly and swiftly. To return to the truce of 1921, I will recite an incident which illustrates an effective application of Republican justice. Ireland is a very moral country, but brothels occasionally flourish in some of the port cities. An American sailor had paid a call at one of these fleshpots and paid rather dearly for his moment of pleasure. He was robbed, and like all men caught in such a predicament, he decided to suffer in silence rather than reveal his loss and shame. Like many other American sailors during the conflict, he had rendered service to the Republicans. There was a constant liaison with America via the stokehold and engine room. The following night, he was scheduled to sail home on the steamer Lake Lemoru. He broke down and confessed his predicament to a longshoreman. The lad lost the watch that his father gave him, a ring that his mother left him at her death, sundry trinkets, and money. The old docker bristled up at the story and started away, telling the sailor to wait for him. Back came the old man in half an hour, accompanied by his son, a member of Company B of the Dublin Brigade of the IRA. "Do you know the house?" the soldier asked. "Yes, but my ship is due to sail. I can give you the address." The sailor handed over a slip of paper and then wrote out a descriptive list of the items stolen. "When are you coming back?" said the Republican volunteer. "In 6 weeks." "Father will give you the jewelry then, or he'll tell you where you can get it." That casual remark sounded like a boast, but the volunteer made good, and I was an eyewitness to the actual recovery of the loot. I was at the headquarters of the Dublin Brigade when Shanahan, the commandant of Company B, came over to where I was reading. "Mac, I'm going to raid a house in Monto. Want to come along?" "Sure thing," said I, for Montgomery Street was then a dubious district, much trafficked by sailors and Dublin's transient population. Monto, or Montgomery Street as it is correctly labelled, is in the very shadow of the Catholic Cathedral, though I am confident the church fathers were in ignorance of the building's reputation. As I looked the part of a ship's officer on a mission of pleasure, I was selected to knock on the door. The brusque madame who answered my summons with surprising alacrity viewed me with some doubt. 7 o'clock in the evening was probably rather early for the type of visitors who frequented the house. However, I gained admission and gave the signal. The others swept in behind me while I held the door ajar. "Get out, all of ye," madame demanded. "What's the idea of trooping into my house like a lot of cattle?" By this time, the voices had excited the women of the house, and they hurried from their rooms to join the clamour. When the first bedlam ceased, Commandant Shanahan explained the nature of the visit and requested permission to search the premises. "Get out of here, you pack of dirty thieves! You can't ransack my house!" Shanahan abandoned his courteous tact and drew his Colt 45. "We're going to turn the house inside out," he said curtly, "until we find what we're looking for. You can save yourself a lot of cleaning up if you get me the watch, rings, and money you stole from that American sailor the other night." "I've got nothing at all," she replied sullenly, being subdued by the sight of the pistols. Then the business of the raid began in earnest. Guards were posted at the doors to prevent escape. Men were assigned to every one of the four floors and the basement. The place was turned topsy-turvy, but not a trinket was found. Shanahan called the squad together for a conference. The old hag and her inmates were rounded into one room and subjected to search. There was not a penny in their pockets and hardly a ring on a single finger. Madame complained bitterly at the shame and indignity cast upon her girls, but Shanahan silenced her. Another search was made of the house, but with no result. We were about to leave when Shanahan missed the madame. The commandant rushed upstairs and a few of us followed him. There she was, praying before a miniature shrine. A taper flickered in a tiny sanctuary lamp. He turned to me in rage. This act of blasphemy was too much for Shanahan. Behind the plaster image, we beheld a neat little safe. "Open that safe or give me the keys," demanded Shanahan. But Madame did nothing but curse us bitterly. There was a pocket in her jacket, and, fuming and kicking, someone held her arms while Shanahan found a bunch of keys there. He failed to open the safe, however, because the key worked in conjunction with a set of tumblers. In disgust, he turned to one of his men. "Go down to the munition plant and bring up Foley with some drills and nitroglycerine. We'll blow a hole through the building to open this safe if needs be." The soldier was prepared to follow instructions when Madame asked for the keys. Shanahan gave them to her and she swiftly opened the safe. What a sight! It was crammed with jewelry. Right in front of the collection was the timepiece and rings belonging to the American sailor. The watch was still ticking. The loot was confiscated and sold at public auction, the proceeds being turned over to the Belfast Refugee Relief Fund. When the American sailor stepped off the steamer Lake Lemoro, he was greeted by the old stevedore. "Here are your watch and ring, lad," said the old man. That was all. It was an interesting example of the direct methods used by the Irish Republican commanders in the enforcement of a rudimentary system of justice.